Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the incredible Creekside Room, today's speaker is Stephen Zunis, and he will be speaking on Behind the Islamic Resurgence. So let's listen in on Stephen Zunis.
So today, first of all, just have everybody go around briefly and say their name and where they're from, and maybe any brief optional tidbit about themselves, whether they're on staff or they're, you know, a pastor, or they've spent time in the Middle East, or, you know, whatever little thing you want to say about yourself that's, that you can do in 10 seconds or less. And also, please mention if you were here for the thing on for my presentation on Tuesday evening. There's going to be a little bit of overlap, and just how much will depend on some part on how many of you have heard some of the stuff before.
Do you want me to start?
Yeah.
I'm Ryan Arzisi. I'm from Libertyville, Washington. I'm on staff in
My name is Cressy, and I'm from Libby, Montana, and I'm on staff, and I was here for half a year. My name is Christina Boga, I'm from Seattle, and I have two younger children, and yes, Terry, but not here Tuesday.
I'm Judy Newman from Whitby Island, I was here Tuesday, and I'm particularly interested in my son who's over there during the war. There's lots of stories to tell.
And
I'm Naomi Aurora, I'm also from Libby Island.
Marianne from Canada, I think I've heard most of your sessions.
I'm Walter from Vancouver, British Columbia, and I was
here
Tuesday.
I'm Kathy Larson from Seattle, with a husband and three kids wandering around, and I wasn't here Tuesday.
I'm John Edberg from Minneapolis, I'm a guest here, I'm a teacher, and I was not here on Tuesday.
Wayne Krauss from North Vancouver, BC. I'm the guest here. I'll be here with your sessions.
Paul James, I'm in Arizona. I'm teaching staff this week. And I was here Tuesday.
From Bracelet, Calgary, Alberta, 2 days ago. Our high was 69. Love the weather. I was here Tuesday.
Sharon Moore from Sam, Oregon. I was here Tuesday, but I forgot to move steps.
There you go. I'm Bat Moore, also from Salem. I was here Tuesday night, and I remember at least part of what I was saying.
I'm Virginia Walker, I'm from Kansas, I'm a guest. My first time here, and I also my first session with you.
I'm Sherry from North Vancouver, BC.
Start just with a review of what Islam is about. The word Islam basically means submission. That is, you are submitting to God. Muslim is the term that's usually used for one who practices Islam. The term Mohammedan is incorrect. Because Muslims do not worship Muhammad. Muhammad is seen as mortal, we are called Christians because we worship Christ, but Mohammedan is not a proper usage, because again, Muhammad is seen as the one of a line of great, the last and most significant of the prophets. These prophets include some familiar names, of course, Abraham, Moses, virtually all the Old Testament prophets, as well as Jesus. Jesus is seen by Muslims as one of the great prophets. He's, many of the stories that are familiar to us are in the Quran. They do not see Jesus as the Son of God. They do not see Jesus as the Messiah. But as a result, both Jews and Christians are known in Islam as people of the book. And there's been a tradition of respect for Jews and Muslims. Now, there's never been full equality for non-Muslims in Arab countries, but discrimination, persecution against Jews and Muslims has been very, very rare historically. Things got pretty rough for Jews soon after the creation of Israel in Muslim countries, but by and large, there's been widespread tolerance of their fellow monotheistic faiths. And I'll talk about that in a little more detail later, but basically, Islam grew out of Christian and Judaism, and Islamic thought God is the center of the universe, omnipotent, just, and merciful, and humankind is God's highest creation, that's limited and commits sin, can be tempted by Satan. You're pretty familiar. There are five basic principles of Islam, often known as the pillars of Islam. One is belief in God, which is to be professed by Muslims repeatedly, basically. There's no God but God, and Muhammad is his prophet. Allah is simply the Arabic word for God. As the old joke says, we call our Creator by many names, God, Allah, Jehovah, but it's all the same. You say it Yahweh, and I'll say it mine. But we do pray to the same God. A second principle is alms for the poor. Charity is very, very important. Prayer. Muslims are supposed to pray five times a day, traditionally in the direction of Mecca. It's quite interesting. You go to a hotel room in the Muslim country, and they have up there by the telephone and other things a little arrow that points, so you know which way to pray. Fasting during the holy month of Ramadan is an important component from dawn to dusk. No food or water. They're flexible about that. Not pregnant or nursing women don't have to do it. People traveling great distances don't have to. Their children don't have to. But that fasting, that kind of self-sacrifice, is a real, real key piece. And finally, pilgrimage to Mecca. Again, if possible, if you can afford it. Again, they're not rigid about it. You're no less of a Muslim if you don't make it for financial or whatever reasons. But it's a dream of many Muslims to do so. And some of the wealthier governments, like Saudi Arabia, will subsidize the Hajj, as they call it, this pilgrimage. Sunni Islam, the Orthodox primary branch of Islam, which a good 90% of Muslims subscribe to, is egalitarian and non-hierarchical in structure. Shia Islam, the Shiites, which is the minority branch of Islam, which dominates in Iran and parts of Lebanon and Yemen, is more hierarchical. They have what they call ayatollahs, which are, you know, like bishops or cardinals or whatever. But most Muslims, it's decentralized in that regard. Yeah.
Could you talk about how those two separated?
I am a political scientist. I'm not a scholar of Islam, but it was only a couple of generations after Muhammad. It was a battle over the chosen successor. And they do have some real doctrinal differences, but they are, and you know, it's comparable to the schisms between Catholicism and Protestantism and Orthodox churches. Some Muslims they're just like many Christians take the differences more seriously than they see them as more important than others. Islam, in virtually every country where it spread, was a progressive force. That is, their emphasis on equality, on social justice, it was a very emancipatory, liberating kind of thing. It's why it spread so rapidly. The word came from conquering armies, but there are no forced conversions. People weren't, converted at sword point or anything like that. They basically got forces out of the way that would prevent them from spreading the word. But once these forces are out of the way, it spread very, very fast. It spread well beyond the Arab world. Indeed, a good 90% of Arabs are Muslims, but most Muslims are not Arabs. You have throughout South Asia, Southeast Asia, you have the largest Muslim country actually is Indonesia, Southeast Asia. Islam spread deep into Black Africa. You have pockets of Islam even in the New World. It's spreading quite a bit in the United States. Why in the United States? In fact, I saw some statistics. There are more Muslims in the United States than there are Episcopalians. And it's spread not just among immigrants from Muslim countries, but but very strongly in the African American community, as well as a surprising number of white Americans who have, for whatever reason, stumbled upon Islam and have embraced it. Story the other night about a guy from a Gustavus Adolphus College professor from an old Swedish Lutheran family who converted. There's some undeniable appeal in many, many quarters. I should mention as a footnote that the Nation of Islam, the West Farrakhan's group, is not considered to be truly Muslim by most Muslims. Basically, what the Nation of Islam espouses is this idea that white people were essentially made by the devil. And traditional Islam rejects that because traditional Islam stresses a strict equality among the races. The separatism and anti-white kinds of sentiments, indeed, and anti-Jewish sentiments as well, have been are rejected by most mainstream Muslims. Only a minority of African American Muslims are Black Muslims. Most African American Muslims are of the mainstream. One thing a lot of people don't realize is that Islam, at least relative for its time, was quite progressive regarding women. Women were severely oppressed and traditional Middle Eastern societies. Female infanticide was common. And Islam, and in the Quran, is very explicit about equality of the races. Now there's a certain separate but equal philosophy, which many Muslim countries resent. But a lot of their stereotypes of these harems or harems of scantily clad women and everything, that is pre-Islamic. That is as unfair stereotype of the Middle East as would medieval palace. analysis be of the contemporary European monarchies. Muslims are allowed to have up to 4 wives, but only in conditions that they can be treated equally. And given just for financial reasons alone, it's very difficult. You find it very, very unusual to find find polygamy in almost any Muslim countries, except among certain elite sectors and only a minority of those. There is nothing in the Quran that says anything about the veiling of women. The veil was originally something used by upper class Christian women in Middle Eastern countries. That basically was of the attitude that, okay, you know, since we are above you, don't you dare look upon our face, but we can look at yours, kind of thing. And during the Ottoman occupation of most of the Middle East, and I don't know the exact history of this, the veil was introduced and there was an increasing theme of trying to justify it on Islamic laws. Now, most Muslims do believe there should be some kind of head covering for women. But you know, covering the face is fairly unusual still. I found it was very interesting because I spent some time with refugees from Western Sahara. Western Sahara is a country on the Atlantic coast of North Africa, just south of Morocco, that was invaded by Morocco some years ago. And much of the population was forced into exile. These are traditional nomads. These are devoutly Muslim people. But I found that a large number of the leadership, in fact, a majority of the leadership on the lower and intermediate levels were women. Women could take on virtually any job as males. Women were very very powerful, straightforward, you know, very out there socially, etc. And they say there's nothing at all unusual about this. You know, that they say, you know, all that garbage about women being behind cloistered behind doors or behind veils, that's just a bunch of garbage that the Ottomans or others brought in. You know, they consider people like Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran, others just simple, you know, political reactionaries, the way I think many of us would look upon certain right-wing television evangelists. That they argued basically that whenever a religious faith becomes a state religion, it ends up being used to rationalize for the status quo. And so there's a strong rejection of that. Given all this, why then have we seen a rise in a form of Islam that is undeniably reactionary? One that does rigidly segregate women from men and place women second-class status. That shows very little tolerance of those with dissenting beliefs, including fellow Muslims. That practices violence, often against civilians. Like any kind of reactionary movements or totalitarian movements, it lies in the situation that people in a given culture, given society, find themselves in. Now, the Middle East, North Africa, most of the Muslim world has been colonized at one time or another by Europeans, and that the legacy of that colonialism, that is in pro-Western autocratic leaders that look upon their own self-interest above that of the whole population. Outside intervention, dislocation of populations has created a kind of alienation that has spread widely. And other things they tried have not worked. Arab nationalism, various forms of socialism that we saw in the Ba'ath movements in Iraq and Syria, Nasser in Egypt and others, have failed. Experiments in other forms of left-wing revolutionary socialist movements like in South Yemen, Algeria, they have failed. tentative experiments in democracy. Western style democracy have failed. People are looking for an answer. And Islam is there. It is something that virtually everyone growing up in a Muslim country is familiar with. It's something you can identify with. It's not complicated like Marxian dialectics or anything like that. It's something one can immediately embrace. And for, say, someone who has been dislocated from their traditional farmland, say, because of an open-door economic policy where multinational corporations come and they stop growing food crops and start growing cotton for export, or where war or other problems have led to people fleeing into urban areas. People are lost. They no longer have the common bonds of community, a family that they're used to, and they look for something to identify with. The one thing they can find in this very alien urban environment is the mosque. And inside the mosque, they find what they see as the answer. And basically they're saying that we are having these problems because we have strayed from what is true Islam. And what is true Islam is how certain leaders in the movement will try to interpret it. I mean, it's no accident that the fundamentalist Christian upsurge in this country came after the very radical social changes in the 1960s and early 70s, in reaction to that. And of course, the dislocation in these Islamic countries is far greater than anything we experienced with the sexual revolution, with the drugs, with Vietnam and its aftermath, with the urban decay, with all the kind of things that got a lot of people upset and searching. And a lot of it is fed upon by rejection of Western materialist values. That basically the model of development that has generally been foisted upon the third world by the first world has been one of consumerism, of materialism, which very few people can actually afford, because the economies of Middle Eastern countries, like most third world countries, are generally set up to export raw materials for finished products. And you cannot get a self-sustaining economy where you can get a stable middle class and stable democratic institutions that way. You'll get some elites who will profit enormously within the country from that kind of system. But it doesn't spread the wealth. We're not even talking about lack of socialism. We're talking about real capitalism. You know, the kind that at least in theory should trickle down a little bit. And so they see this this sacrificing their culture, their society, what's important to them, on this altar of very crass materialism, the allure of Western consumer goods and Western culture. And to them, for example, the issue of women, is it more degrading to women to keep them behind a veil, to keep them in the home, to keep them in away from certain occupations, than for having scantily clad women on billboards, to have strip joints, prostitution, fashions designed deliberately to titillate men, the whole, that is women's liberation in the eyes of many Muslims. They want nothing of it. So in many ways, these people are saying, in reaction to this influx of this massive Western culturalization that's come through the spread of Western economics, it has had both a dislocating factor in terms of many people can't make a living anymore, they're unemployed, alienated, so Islam is an attraction, but also a convenient target for the alienation as they are barraged by what's there. It's very interesting to see the fundamentalist movement in Egypt, which since the rise of Anwar Sadat has really grown as a response to this open door policy to Western consumerism. That when you look at the assassinations committed by these fundamentalists, they have generally been against, you know, 90% of the time, against corrupt elites that are affiliated with the system. They have killed Coptic Christians, who make up about 10% of the Egyptian population, but generally, again, those who are part of the elite. They haven't killed people just for being Christian. They have not killed, for example, Muslims, the large number of Muslims in parts of rural Egypt, which still, like many Christians in certain areas with old animistic faiths, kind of blend together, you know, Islamic saints with traditional Pharaonic, you know, temple, you know, gods and goddesses. I mean, that is, what's the term for that? Whatever, I mean, something that, it's something that would, you know, you'd think that, you know, you'd want to easily get shot for, but they don't. They focus on, again, the elites. Many of these people would essentially be Marxists 20 years ago. They are fighting a corrupt, authoritarian, hierarchical, and blatantly unfair and inequitable system. But they use Islam as the organizing force.
What is a Coptic Christian?
It's an Eastern Orthodox rite that is centered in Egypt. They're a good 6 or 8 or maybe even 10 million Egyptians who subscribe to the Coptic faith. They've been around since around at least around the 4th century. You know, they're one of the older branches of Christianity. And you know, they've been successful in commerce and government and academia. In fact, Boutros Ghali, who is the Secretary General of the United Nations, is a Coptic Christian. So we have this, and if you look at the places where Islamic fundamentalist movements have arisen, it's been places where there has been this kind of gross disruption of society. Afghanistan's an obvious example. When this minority communist government enacted what, in many ways, are progressive reforms, but they are basically, you agree with us or you'll get shot, and was a very totalitarian thing, and especially when they brought in tens of thousands of Soviet troops and heavy bombardment, killed hundreds of thousands of civilians, led to this kind of Islamic reaction. Iran, where for decades the United States backed a very corrupt, authoritarian, dictatorial regime in the form of the Shah. Indeed, the United States was responsible for the overthrow of their constitutional government back in 1953, and the CIA and other U.S. agencies were directly involved in internal security, including torture, widespread torture. And it so wiped out the opposition, any kind of democratic or secular opposition. The Islamic opposition is virtually the mosque about the only place people could organize anymore. If you look at Lebanon, which has been subjected to widespread bombardment in the past 20 years by the Israelis and the Shiite Muslim areas in the south, this has led to the rise of Hezbollah and radical groups. The Islamic fundamentalism was not even a factor in Lebanon until after the Israeli invasion in 1982 and the U.S. military intervention that followed. The so-called Muslims, the 1975-76 civil wars, were actually a larger secular grouping, which included large numbers of Christians and leftists and others. Palestine. Palestine traditionally been one of the most tolerant Middle Eastern societies. There's generally about 20% Christian minority, and they live side by side with Muslims quite well historically. But again, with the establishment of Israel and crowding hundreds of thousands of refugees in this tiny coastal area inside of the Gaza Strip, and the failure of the United States and the and Israel to accept the PLO's offer for peace and return to a Palestinian mini-state. They have also turned to extremist, fundamentalist form of Islam. Algeria, where a supposedly progressive revolution up going into Soviet-style central planning and heavy industrialization, and he left the agricultural sector, again leading to widespread dislocation, corruption, has led to the Islamic reaction that we're seeing in that country as well. So every place you see a rise in this kind of this phenomenon have been places where there has been some major social dislocation, and people are trying to identify with something. So let me address real briefly before opening it up to questions. Where the U.S. policy comes in. Now, I've analyzed the reason there's conflict in the Middle East is the reason there's conflict elsewhere in the third world. You have a huge gap between the rich and the poor, both within countries and between countries, the rich oil states versus the majority of Arab states, which are quite poor. You have a high level of militarism. You have a lot of weapons. You have autocratic rulers. You have economies geared towards exports of raw materials, finished goods, which increases this inequality. And in all these areas, the Middle East is the worst of any area in the third world. Add to that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, a very unjust. The Palestinians call for national self-determination is still rejected by the major players, Israel and the United States. So all this combined to really give Islamic extremism a legitimacy in the eyes of many Arabs and Iranians and others. What's U.S. policy then? Basically, the U.S., our closest allies in the Arab world, are among the most autocratic, corrupt regimes there are. The Gulf's monarchies, Egypt, Morocco. The United States is a chief arms supplier. We've sent over $40 billion worth of highly sophisticated arms to the Middle East since the Gulf War alone, primarily to autocratic regimes. The United States rejected the establishment of a Middle East Development Bank that the Europeans and Japanese and Arab oil states are ready to move forward on. One that would have done a lot to ease this sense of inequality, largely because we need that as petrodollars to buy arms and to help bail out our banks and other and the trade deficits and buy out our national debt. We didn't want it to go back in to the Middle East because we need that cash ourselves. In effect, the very things that are breeding Islamic fundamentalism, the United States has encouraged. In fact, in some cases, the U.S. has even supported fundamentalist movements. So the seven major factions fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan, the vast majority of USA went to the most hardline extremist faction, which has been wreaking absolute havoc on Afghanistan ever since the pro-communist regime was toppled. It hasn't gotten the news much, but people are dying at a faster rate than they were during the Soviet invasion. Horrific things going on there. The United States had no problems with working with the Iranian regime on a whole number of areas. The Iran-Contra scandal was but one. But one footnote I mentioned the other night, which a lot of people don't realize, was that Sheikh Rahman, the guy who's been indicted in the World Trade Center bombing, was considered a CIA asset and was allowed to get around immigration clearance, despite his record of terrorism, because he had been recruiting American Muslims to fight with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, which is why he got through. And now, of course, his arrest and that has led to his increasing anti-immigration and anti-Islamic sentiments here in the United States. But I think we're going to see more and more conflict as between the Islamic world and the West until these underlying issues are addressed. And I'd be happy to answer any questions or hear anybody sharing their thinking on this issue or challenging anything I said so far regarding anything I mentioned on this broad topic or more.
On the one hand, you said that the United States has supported some of the more reactionary elites. On the other hand, you said they've also supported some of the most extreme fundamentalists in other situations. Is there any organizing principle for U.S. policy? I mean, I suppose oil, but aside from that, or are we just so enamored of brokering every side in the big monopoly game that it gets out of control? And
I think it's basically
the enemy last week is the ally this week.
Sure, I think it's mostly big power politics. I mean, the support of the Iranian clerics and of the Mujahideen were because they were apparently anti-communist. I gave the example the other night of how the U.S., through a Soviet defector, got a list of 1,000 activists in the clandestine Communist Party in Iran, handed it over to the mullahs, and they were largely massacred. You know, and so as a nice anti-communist force, we were happy to work with the Iranians and with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. We support the most extremists in large part because we were afraid that more moderate ones might come to compromise with the Soviets. We wanted someone who could bleed the group that would never compromise and essentially bleed the Soviets dry. Ironically now, Islam is seen as a bigger threat. In places like Uzbekistan and some of the former Soviet Central Asian states, we in the U.S. has actually backed former communist, in fact, former maybe too nice a word, Communist Party hardliners in the name of curbing the Islamic threat within these Asian states, even though the Islamic movements in Central Asia are actually fairly modern progressive because of the strong Sufi influence in that part of the world. Again, not all Islamic movements are of this very reactionary fundamentalist variety. Some are, you know, comparable to, you know, the liberation theology of Latin America, or have very progressive elements as well. So I think it, you know, again, it's playing, you know, one side off against another. There's a moderate Islamic party that shares power in Yemen that the U.S. has felt, you know, that the U.S. has felt open to working with some. It varies. I don't think we know much. I don't think there are many people in high places that really know a whole lot about what we're doing.
But there's no philosophical principle. It's just tip this way to the end.
Yeah, sure. And there are plenty of ironies. I mean, for example, you know, for years we refused to talk with the PLO. In fact, before the Israel had to meet with the PLO secretly in Norway before the peace process could get anywhere, because we barred the PLO from taking part in the peace talks. Even the PLO was being very moderate and saying, you know, we'll live alongside Israel in this Palestinian mini-state. Meanwhile, we're getting real close to, meanwhile we are, you know, supporting Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, elements of which, of their government of which, are funding Hamas, which is the extremist Islamic fundamentalist movement among the Palestinians that wants Israel wiped off the map. And so it gets pretty confused sometimes.
Can you give an analysis of some of the leaders, such as Assad in Syria, Saddam Hussein, Arafat?
Well, all the three you mentioned are secular. They're Muslims, raised Muslim. I don't know how many of them are practicing. They all have Christians in their governments. A number of leaders of the PLO, including some of them were extremist leaders, like George Habash. He's the head of the Popular Front for Liberation of Palestine, which used to hijack, remember all those airline hijackings back in the 70s? He's from a Greek Orthodox family. And Tariq Aziz, Saddam Hussein's foreign minister, you saw in the news a lot during the Gulf War, is Christian. One of my favorite scenes was at the Madrid conference when these right-wing American fundamentalists were going around saying that all the land should belong to Israel because the Bible says so. They ran into Anan Ashrawi, who is the chief spokesperson for the Palestinian delegation, who started quoting Bible verse after Bible verse, showing how they were misquoting and misleading, things like that. She's a devout Episcopalian. Both Assad and Saddam Hussein have cracked down very harshly against Islamic fundamentalists. In 1982, there was a fundamentalist Islamic uprising in Syria, And Assad had his troops surround the city of Hama, which is in northern, north central Syria, beautiful city, I've been there, and basically just opened guns on some of the poor neighborhoods and killed as many as 20,000 civilians in a matter of a week, just level of vice. And these are pretty, I mean, the rebels are pretty extremist. They ended up, you know, massacring, you know, all the appointed government officials and stuff, and they're a pretty nasty group, but the crackdown was, you know, it was a massacre big time. It worked, I mean, it stopped the, stopped the revolution cold. And certainly Saddam Hussein has been very, very anti any kind of fundamentalist thing, because there's a majority Shiite population in Iraq, even though he's Sunni, and many of them have ties to Iran. And the widespread massacres against Islamic movements in the south, going as far as drying up the marshes, which is the home of the Marsh Arab population in the south, and enormous environmental consequences. But and in addition, there have been, you know, massacres by the thousands by his forces as well. At the same time, both of them, including Saddam Hussein, has been able to use Islamic sentiment against the West to their advantage. He's got a number of major Islamic conferences in Baghdad to rally to his cause against the United States. And in fact, in one of these one of the post-war raids on Baghdad, a U.S. missile slammed right into the luxury hotel Al Rashid, where actually where I stayed during my most recent visit to Iraq, right where this conference was taking place. Only killed a couple of hotel employees, fortunately, but you better believe they all thought it was at the, you know, that missile was aimed at them. And they also had ammunition because of the incredible corruption of the monarchies to the south, which the fundamentalists hate because, for one thing, they're greedy. They're not showing, they're keeping the oil money or going to Monte Carlo gambling casinos or putting in London real estate or whatever, not sharing wealth with their Muslim brethren. And also, and again, I mentioned this the other night, but it's a really good illustrative story of how they use Islam to they twist things to their use. I think it's either the emir of Kuwait or his brother, I forget which one, who has four wives and divorces one every week and gets a new one for the week, and then divorces, gets a new one. So technically, he's within the law, but any self-respecting Muslim would say that's clearly an abuse. Similarly, they say, well, they drink alcohol. They say, well, the Quran just says, you know, don't drink wine, don't say anything about beer or whiskey. But, you know, again, any self-respecting Muslim could tell you that the prohibition is, you know, they may have said wine is, in fact, universal regarding alcohol. So there's a lot of, you know, say these playboy princes, you know, going all over the place. And again, the resentment is very, very strong, because Islam can be relatively tolerant of authoritarian leadership. But if you're going to rule, you need to be godly. You need to be righteous. You cannot be corrupt. You can be authoritarian, but you can't be corrupt. And these regimes are pretty darn corrupt. And one thing you can say about Saddam Hussein and Hafez Assad is they have at least redistributed wealth a bit in their countries. You know, these are quasi-socialist kind of states. I mean, and again, totalitarian dictatorships by any measure, but at least, you know, the common person is, you know, getting a piece of the pie, which is more than you can say for a lot of these other, some of these monarchies.
When a new administration, like the U.S., comes into power, does the State Department ever undertake a review of their foreign policy or change their foreign policy? It seems, from what you've been saying, regardless of what administration is in, it just perpetuates the same policy through and through.
Well, there's generally, foreign policy is made at a pretty much bipartisan elite level. It does not change that significantly. And that's why when I talk about Israeli-Palestinian stuff, I downplay the pro-Israel lobby, because I really think that even if, that no one lobbying group really has a foreign policy decision making is not that pluralistic. And any one powerful group, any lobby group, even a fairly powerful one, doesn't really reach that can reach quite that level. And I think there is quite a bit of confusion and waffling, and we see in Bosnia, which the impact that Bosnia has had on the Muslim world is extraordinary. It's become the only thing I can think of as equivalent was what Spain was to the left in the 1930s. Bosnia is to Muslims today. That is, it is the ultimate cause celebre. And here are Bosnians who are European by any measure, cosmopolitan, educated, Western, would happen to be Muslims, wanting a democratic, secular Bosnia to get out of the way of the madness of that crazy war between the Serbs and the Croats. We don't want to be divided up in this Croat-Serbian war, which is really silly. You know, we're all Serbo-Croatian ethnically. We all speak the same language. The only thing distinguishes Serbs and Croats is Orthodox, Greek Orthodoxy and Catholicism. And of course, and the Muslims, it basically is how the Austro-Hungarian and Eastern extended the old Russian and the Ottoman empires happen to divide things up. But we want to have a democratic secular state here, only to be subjected to near genocidal attacks by and again, the excuses the Serbs use was Islamic fundamentalism is going to strike at Europe, which anybody who's actually been to Sarajevo or knows any Bosnian Muslims knows is totally ludicrous. And you know, they see the world stand by while this is happening and wonder what if it had been Muslims attacking a Christian, massacring Christians instead of Christians massacring Muslims, would the West have stood by the way it did? And the very fact they asked the question, I think, says a lot about the answer. So, again, this is, and a lot of what's been in the state, and I think the ambivalence and the back and forth we've seen in U.S. foreign policy circles, I think, is indicative. And I don't know, I personally don't know what really the answer is or what the U.S. should do there. But it's clear that people who should be thinking about these things have had a real hard time figuring it out and giving quite a few mixed signals. Similarly, in Lebanon, in the early stages of the civil war, when you had the Muslim majority supporting the establishment of a democratic secular country in Lebanon, the West largely sided with the Falangists, which was a neo-fascist Christian Maronite movement, which engaged in widespread massacres of civilian populations. And so the Muslims say, hey, look, we try to be democratic and secular and Western. What does the West do but abandon us? So, therefore, we have to embrace this particularly virulent reactionary form of Islam as the only protection against this kind of Western hypocrisy and attacks and whatever.
I noticed the church synods and the ELCA were passing resolutions about the situation of Bosnia, old Yugoslavia. But they were repeating this phrase that I find to be a double dirty euphemism, ethnic cleansing. And as you pointed out, all of these people are the same ethnic background, they're all Slavic. And it's certainly not cleansing either, it's a bloodbath. It's a religious bloodbath. Mm-hmm. And to find that religious groups will not acknowledge that, but will keep using the same double dirty euphemism that the press uses is a little bit disconcerting. Do you have any comment on that? I mean, I think in order to deal with the situation, you have to label it correctly.
Yeah. It's, they do see themselves in many ways as, I think a lot of it depends on your version of ethnicity.
Yeah.
It may not be that, in fact, that might even have been a term the Serbs came up with, I'm not sure. But, I don't know, I mostly just see what the reaction has been in the Islamic world, because to them it just brings back the days of the Crusades and the huge bloodbaths that took place there. And the irony that, that you have Westerners seeing the Muslims as being bloodthirsty when there's been far more violence, not just historically, but even the past 20, 30 years. I mean, far more Muslims have been killed by forces from the West than Westerners have been killed by Muslims. The example I gave the other night is that the U.S. organized, trained, and financed Contras in Nicaragua killed far more civilians than any combination of Arab, Palestinian, Muslim terrorist groups in the past 20, 30 years combined. And you know, who are we to? And you know, and the Contras, as you recall, were supported by the in large part by religious broadcasters, Christian religious broadcasters here in the United States. So if you're someone in a Muslim country hooking up to American TV, how is Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell praising the Contras any different than us hearing Ayatollah Khomeini or his successors praising these Islamic terrorists in Lebanon or somewhere else? And I guess, just to add on this a little more, just as many Jews who have experienced the Holocaust and widespread repression see every attack of terrorism, every bellicose broadcast from Islamic movement or country or whatever, bringing back all these fears of being wiped out, so does every Israeli or American bombing raid in a Muslim area, or the ongoing slaughters in Bosnia or whatever, bring back the old fears from the Crusades and other repeated histories of attacks from the West. And it leads to, you know, and just as Israel's reacted oftentimes to violence and terrorism and threats in very violent and terrible ways, so are the Muslims. And just as many otherwise normal, progressive, thoughtful American Jews will rationalize for these, you know, extreme Israeli reactions, so you'll often hear some fairly otherwise reasonable Muslims rationalizing for these kind of attack, terrorist attacks, because it just stirs up all this fear and isolation, anxiety inside.
So how does the average Joe Blow out there who casts his vote every 4 years do about this? You sit and talk about it, but what do you do about it?
I think that there is, a lot of those Joe Blows are probably in your congregations. I think many of you are old enough to recall very vividly how prevalent anti-Semitism was, open anti-Semitism. I mean, there's still a lot of anti-Semitism around, but it's not considered a good thing to do. I mean, it's now generally frowned upon, and, you know, it's if you had those kind of sentiments, you know, to kind of at least keep them fairly quiet, at least at church on Sunday or, you know, whatever, in those respectable quarters. And a large part of that was the churches, decisions by churches to do interfaith dialogue, to have, you know, interfaith councils in their communities, to work with Jewish congregations on issues of common concern, learn about Jewish traditions. Some churches have Passovers and Seders, for example. You know, bringing together the Catholic Church, you know, Vatican II, you know, renouncing anti-Semitism and some of the old garbage that Rome had, blaming Jews collectively for the death of Christ, and ELCA, of course, has taken a critical look at some of Martin Luther's statements that can certainly be seen as anti-Semitic, and we're looking at these kind of issues and struggling with them. That's very good and very important. We need to do that with Islam as well. You know, if there is a mosque in your community, invite them. Do you know, same way you would interact with synagogues. share, you know, have dialogue, share and learn, see that these people don't have horns, you know. and notice all the things that Islam and Christianity have in common. I mean, I imagine most Americans think Islam is like, you know, Hinduism or, you know, or some native, you know, cult. I mean, they don't realize how similar it is. It's at least similar to Christianity as Judaism is. But it might as well be some kind of heathen, you know, whatever. So I think that, you know, prejudice comes from prejudging. Prejudging comes from not knowing. And so I think just to have more contact with Muslims in your lives. And encourage people in your churches to have these interfaith dialogues and meet with people, talk to people, and bring people together. And I think it can be a very useful, growthful experience. And you know, just sharing casually in conversation some stuff you learned in this workshop or stuff that you learned on your own or whatever, to at least get people talking about these kinds of things. Because it's amazing. Because you have these right-wing religious broadcasters claiming things. I've actually heard this on the radio. Saying that Muslims believe that if they kill a Christian, they can go to heaven forever. There's nothing in Islam that says that. I mean, Jerry Falwell has said things about Islam that are just as bad as what Louis Farrakhan has said about Judaism. But you don't have the media jumping on him like you do Farrakhan. You don't have them yelling at George Bush to or Ronald Reagan to renounce Falwell the way they insist that Jesse Jackson or black politicians renounce Farrakhan every time he says he or his lieutenants say something anti-Semitic, you know. But we need to challenge the prejudice against Islam. Every much as we do prejudice against Jews, and remember, Arabs are also Semites. It is another form of anti-Semitism, basically.
Just a quick comment that sometimes opportunities can come out of tragedies. The congregation that I belong to in Minneapolis is, with several other churches in our denomination, sponsoring a Bosnian refugee family. Mm-hmm. And that is creating a real opportunity for cooperation with the Islamic Center in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. So just the fact that that crisis exists has created a reason for there to be some kind of interfaith cooperation.
Does the Middle East have quite the same memory as the Europe? And I mean memory as in different wars and how different countries were betrayed and then different pacts and stuff like that, dating all the way back to pre.
Yes, but they're also, like Europe, building bridges and reconciling. I mean, like France and Germany, how close they cooperate now after how many centuries of war and hostility. In the Arab world, there's a tradition of, you know, you can be really, of reconciliation. You can be at war one day and be, you know, if there's a genuine reconciliation, it's heartfelt and coming together. But there are indeed memory, but that assumes that people are willing to come together on equal terms and not be arrogant and pretend that they are not responsible for their share of the violence. A classic example was after the Shah died, the Iranian government gave signals that they're willing to release all the hostages if the U.S. simply apologized for overthrowing their democratic government in 1953 and apologized for, you know, sending all this torture equipment, and I think those of you who weren't here, I talked in some detail about the U.S. you know, actually sent electric cattle prods to Iran where they don't raise cattle, and other torture equipment, and how the CIA actually brought in former German SS officers to train the Iranian secret police in so-called interrogation techniques. I mean, the American crimes in Iran are just manifold, just incredible, and all they're asking is just apologize, and let these guys go. And someone asked Jimmy Carter at a press conference, shouldn't the U.S. apologize for, you know, what we did in 53 and subsequently? And he said, oh, that's ancient history. Well, to Iranians, which have a 4,000-year-old tradition, 25 years earlier, 1953, and I think the subsequent things were not ancient history to them. There's hardly an Iranian who did not lose a member of their immediate family